Glory to you, O Lord.
Jesus put before the crowds another parable. The kingdom of heaven may be compared to someone who sowed good seed in his field. But while everybody was asleep, an enemy came and sowed weeds among the wheat, and then went away. So when the plants came up and bore grain, then the weeds appeared as well. And the slaves of the householder came and said to him, Master, did you not sow good seed in your field? Where then did these weeds come from? He answered, An enemy has done this. The slaves said to him, Then do you want us to go and gather them? But he replied, No, for in gathering the weeds, you would uproot the wheat along with them. Let both of them grow together until the harvest, and at harvest time I will tell the reapers, Collect the weeds first and bind them in bundles to be burned, but gather the wheat into the barn. Then he left the crowds and went into the house, and his disciples approached him, saying, Explain to us the parable of the weeds of the field. He answered, The one who sows the good seed is the Son of Man. The field is the world, and the good seed are the children of the kingdom. The weeds are the children of the evil one, and the enemy who sowed them is the devil. The harvest is the end of the age, and the reapers are angels. Just as the weeds are collected and burned up with fire, so will it be at the end of the age. The Son of Man will send his angels, and they will collect out of his kingdom all causes of sin and all evildoers. And they will throw them into the furnace of fire, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. Then the righteous will shine like the sun in the kingdom of their Father. Let anyone with ears listen.
Praise to you, O Christ.
Am I the only one who has ever wondered about the story in Genesis about the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? What is so wrong with knowing the difference between good and evil? You'd think that that would be a really important thing to know if you're going to lead a pious life, to have some sense of good and evil, right? But this week, looking at the warning in the parable about destroying the wheat with the weeds, it occurs to me that perhaps the reason God did not want us knowing the difference between good and evil was because we are not wired to hold the two together. Once we are aware of the distinction, our impulse is always, like the servants in the parable, to associate with the good and to get rid of the evil. And getting rid of the evil has become the very nature of our life together. We tend to gather with people who think like us and cast out or cast judgment over those who do not think like us. If you have any doubt about our incapacity to hold a field of wheat and weeds together, you haven't been paying attention to the spirit of our culture these days. Anyone who disagrees with us is seen as the evil enemy. And we are in turn seen as the evil enemy by those who disagree with us. And we are sure of two very dubious truths. One is that God is on our side, and the other corresponding truth is we, of course, are the wheat. We are the good. Now everyone has their minds around these truths, so that the only way we can think about the knowledge of good and evil is to live our lives over against people who do not think like me, behave like me, believe like me, are not good like me. Our instinct to assign ourselves to the good is reinforced by our capacity to take our own evil, our own brokenness, and project it onto somebody else. A friend of mine told me a story recently of some visitors who spent some time with her a while back. And the visitors came to get a break from where they lived, and they were hoping that it'd be a good week. And these visitors also struggled with alcoholism. And the trip to Chelan, of course, didn't change any of that. And that is a source of great shame for them, their alcohol. In any case, the visitors brought a dog, a very well-behaved dog, they said. Unfortunately, the dog was not as advertised. Big surprise there, right? The dog got into trouble, caused mayhem with the existing pets in the house, ate everything that didn't move. And the owners of the dog and their host one day found themselves in the kitchen, as it became clear that the dog had eaten all the cat food again. And right there in the kitchen, the dog's owners immediately began to shame and blame the dog mercilessly. My friend, who had, truth be known, been pretty upset with the dog herself, in that moment went from frustration to great compassion. The dog was receiving the shame and self-loathing of its owners right there in the middle of the kitchen. And while that was becoming very clear, it dawned on her that the dog, having all the shame and blame heaped on it, upon it, was aptly named. The owners called her PETA, but the dog's name is Pieta, like the Pietà, like the Virgin Mother holding the body of her grown now dead son Jesus on her lap. Pietà, which means pity. The dog having all of that shame placed upon him. The owners dumping all of it upon that dog. The host witnessing all of it and being transformed, moved to pity for all three of the guests now in the kitchen. It all makes me realize how natural is our capacity to project and to divide and to cast our guilt on others and then cast them out as evil weeds. And it makes me realize how Jesus is at work to undo all of this. Not undo our knowledge of good and evil, but certainly undo our way of so terribly dealing with that dangerous distinction. Ours would be to rip up the weeds. Ours would be to discard at first judgment the weeds among us. But Jesus is offering a different way of being, a way that calls for patience and self-examination. He is calling us to see the world the way God has always seen it, with mercy and pity and compassion. The way that God sees it. Isn't it interesting? It's also true that pietà, or pity, is also connected with the word piety. And not holier-than-thou piety that we often seem to think of, but actually living more into the likeness of God, who in the face of good and evil shows mercy and compassion and loving patience, all of which God called forth from my dear friend right there in the kitchen in front of her friends. We aren't normally ready for such a transformation, for such an insight. We can't really generate it ourselves, but the Spirit of Jesus is working in us to bring forth in us piety, pity, compassion. Now, many years ago, during another horrible epidemic, the AIDS epidemic, I was a chaplain for the hospice house for men dying of the disease in North Carolina. And let me have a quick parenthetical remark here. I have not attended the death of anyone who has died of COVID-19. But what I can tell you about the death of men, women, and children who died of the HIV, I can tell you that it is a terrible, terrible death. It is painful, and it does everything it can to strip one of all bodily dignity. All of that while having to die alone, without the support of those that you love. Not for contagion in those days, but for being rejected. I say that in order to say that now there are many people dying alone. And I think it is ours to pray for those who are dying alone. If you have a copy of Peace at the Last, pull it out and pray through it. If you don't know anybody that is dying of COVID-19, pray for all who are, who you do not know, but pray for them. This is our calling. We cannot be there with them, but we can pray for them. And that is really important in these days. Okay, so back back to the AIDS hospice house. The house itself was in a deep part of Duke Forest, hidden, because it was feared that if people knew where the house was, that it would be attacked or harassed in some way. In those days, we were filled with fear and the unknown. And there was our continuing projection of good and evil, and our continuing confusion of wheats and weeds and what to do with them. And so they hid the house. Anyway, one night I was called to tend to a man, Anthony, who was dying. His partner, Joel, was also there tending to him. Anthony's death was near, and he wanted more than anything to be reconciled with his family who had disowned him. He especially wanted to be reconciled with his father. And so he had asked his partner, Joel, days earlier, to call his father and ask him to come to Durham from Georgia. Joel made the call. He made the call even though Anthony's father hated Joel. He thought Joel was the reason that Anthony became a homosexual, and now he was the reason that Anthony was dying. But Joel made the call anyway, and after some days, Anthony's father arrived, Anthony Sr. He arrived in the night, and that's when I was called in. When I arrived, the volunteer brought me to Anthony's father and said under his breath to me, "He's all yours." Anthony Sr. had arrived angry. He was spewing all kinds of venom against homosexuality, against Joel, against the hospice house itself. He just knew that AIDS was God's curse for the sin of homosexuality. And he told me that his pastor at home warned him that he was putting his own soul in peril to even enter the house. All of this in the living room of the place where his son and a dozen like him had finally found a place where they could be accompanied in their dying. As I was doing my best to calm Anthony Sr. down, I was also wondering how I could escort him out of the house quietly. But he didn't want to go outside quietly. He wanted to make his points in the house. Finally, I did calm him down a bit. But even though he drove all the way from Georgia to North Carolina, he still was not interested in seeing his son. At one point, I went in to talk to Anthony Jr., who was wasting away in his bed. I said, "Anthony, your father is here, but he doesn't want to see you or talk to you. I got to tell you, it's pretty ugly." Anthony said to me, "Please, please." So I couldn't, with all of the righteous indignation in me, I couldn't kick the father out of the house. I couldn't pull that weed out and unceremoniously dump him to the curb, which was exactly what I wanted to do. I went back out to be with Anthony Sr., and we talked, and I prayed, and we talked, and I prayed, and finally, his father conceded to go to see his son's room, and in his son's room, and to speak with him. So we walked to the door of the room, and we opened the door, and there's his son in the bed, and there's Joel sitting next to him, and this weed standing next to me begins to sway back and forth. And I realize I have to hold him up, and I do that as best I can. We're stuck in the doorway, though, swaying like weeds or wheat in the wind. And then Joel, God bless Joel. Joel wasn't making any distinctions between wheat and weeds. He had bigger fish to fry. He got out of his seat, came to Anthony Sr., who had nothing but hatred for Joel. He put his arms around him, first to hold him up, and then to escort a father over to the seat next to his dying son. Wheat and weeds together, and something broke open. Tears flowed. Father held his son like a pietà, and kissed his dying forehead. And then he blessed his son. "God be with you," he said. And then he turned to Joel. God be with you, he said. And in that room, angels shining like the sun. Now, if it had been up to me, I would have removed that weed from the wheat, and this transfiguration would never have happened. I know what to do with good and evil. I know the difference between good and evil, after all. But Jesus saves us over and over from that original sin. He shows us the way that God sees us, the way God is patient with us, the way God finally gathers us all in a golden field of compassion. Amen.